Good evening, everyone. Erev Tov. Welcome to Beit Emanuel, Torah Tuesday. This is the week of Parashat Pechudei. Pechudei is the 23rd portion of the Torah. It's also the concluding portion of the book of Shemot, the book of Exodus. So we'll be closing out Exodus this evening. So Pechudei covers chapter 38, verse 21, and goes through the end of the book, which is chapter 40, verse 38. But chapter 38, verse 21 through the end. Often Pechudei is combined with the reading from last week of Vayechel. And this week we'll explain why they are separated this year. It's primarily because where we had a leap day, the Hebrew calendar has a leap month this year. There are 2 months of Adar. And the reason that is because it's a misconception that the Hebrew calendar is lunar. A lot of people think the Hebrew calendar is lunar. The Muslim calendar is lunar. The calendar we are familiar with is solar. And as you might imagine, the Hebrew calendar is both, right? Is it solar or is it lunar? It's both. It balances them. It's primarily lunar in the way that it coordinates its months. However, it always wants the month of Nisan to fall in spring, to be the first month of the year to be the first month of spring. And so in order to do that, it has to occasionally add a leap month. And when it does that, some of the readings that are combined are split, right? And so Pechudei is one of those readings that is split. So we're in the first month of Adar, and when it ends, we'll start Adar again. All right. That's why if you pay attention to the news cycle, you may recall, like, when you hear Ramadan and the Islam calendars being celebrated, you'd be like, seems like I remember that being in the spring. Why is it in the winter? It's because they never reconcile it, right? And so it's purely lunar. And so it's always going to be a different time of the year, those same months. So just a little bit of calendar information there for you. All right, let us get started with the blessing before the study of Torah. Baruch ata Adonai Eloheinu melech haolam, asher kidishanu bo misfitah v'sivanu le'soch v'divrei Torah. Blessed are you, Lord God, King of the universe, who has sanctified us with his commandments and has commanded us to be immersed in the words and the matters of Torah. Amen. So, let's see what Rabbi Avraham Twersky has for us today in Living Each Day. Something that we have actually commented before about in Torah Sparks this year, but I thought his way he handled it was worth kind of revisiting. So he's going to be commenting on Exodus chapter 23, verse 7, where it says, keep a distance from falsehood. And you may recall, if you were in that Torah class, that we talked about building fences around the Torah, and this is one of the cases where the Bible itself builds a fence. And you may remember that discussion. Keep a distance from falsehood. Rabbi Zusha, who was a disciple of the Baal Shem Tov, notes that whereas all other prohibitions are in the form of do not do this or that, but only in regard to falsehood does the Torah command us to keep a distance from it. So most negative commands in the Bible are thou shalt not, and you fill in the blank. But this is the only time where it's phrased as keep a distance from it. So Twersky comments, truth is the foundation of Torah living. Without truth, everything else is meaningless. In the deeper writings, the Satan is the embodiment of falsehood. It is not enough not to lie. We must take great cautions to avoid anything that could in any way contribute to falsehood. If I behave in a way that I might later have to deny, then I am contributing to falsehood because I'm setting myself up to lie at a later date. A simple and good guide to proper human behavior is to ask yourself, would there ever be a reason why I would have to deny having done what I'm about to do? If the answer is yes, then don't do it. And that is keeping a distance from falsehood. It's building a fence so that you don't even get to the position where you might have to lie. If you realize you might have to do it, then that's the Torah saying, don't even go there. So that's why it's phrased different than just, thou shalt not lie. Right? Love your neighbor. As we again take the words of our Messiah, Yeshua, to heart when he says that loving God and loving neighbor, all of Scripture hang on these precepts. So Exodus chapter 39 and verse 35, it speaks of the Ark of the Testimony and the rods that go with it. Now the rods had to remain attached to the Ark even once it was placed in the tabernacle. Exodus 25 verse 15 tells us that. So the Ark was carried, because remember the tabernacle is a mobile worship center. And so the rods were what carry, they would carry the Ark on, or if you've listened to previous classes, more that the Ark carried them on. And it stayed, the rod stayed on the Ark even once it was set in position in the fully set up tabernacle. The reason given for this is that at some point, it would be necessary to depart with the Ark, and it might be necessary to do so hurriedly. Remember, at this point, with the tabernacle, the people are a nomadic people, right? Kind of wandering through the desert. Well, you might encroach on somebody's territory, you might have an enemy coming up on you, there might be a need where you need to leave, and leave in a hurry. And if there were no designated rods, there would not be time to search for the rods that would be the right ones to bear the Ark's weight. And so permanently installed rods would preclude this type of concern. The Ark housed the tablets, which represented the complete Torah, everything that's in the Torah. And when a person immerses himself or herself into the study of the Torah, the Jewish phrase for that is that they have entered the Ark. That they've entered the Ark. And so one may think that while I study Torah, while I study Scripture, while I study God's Word, while I'm deep in prayer, I must focus entirely on this and distance myself from anything else. The needs of another person cannot concern me at this time. What I'm doing is more important than that. Right? So there's this temptation that if you're in the Holy of Holies in your mind, you're involved in something very special, something very deep, something about related to your worship of God and your relationship to God, but you might be tempted to think that right now, in your point in time, that that's more important than someone else's pressing needs. But the message of the permanent rods is that the Ark must always be ready to travel at a moment's notice. Even when the Ark is in the Holy of Holies, which is the holiest place in the world, it must be ready to hurriedly travel to a place in need of its light. And so we love our neighbor as ourselves when no matter how busy we are, even if it's with something holy, even if it's something related to our service of God and our service to God's people, that we must be ready to travel, that we must be ready to respond to the needs of others. All right, so now let's dive into the parashat, Pechudei. Pechudei has several translations for it. You can translate it as accounts, like you're taking an account. You can translate it as reckoning, which is similar to taking accounts. You're reckoning what's here. And it also can kind of mean the appointments of, that you're kind of setting things in order. So the name of this week's portion, Pechudei, and we're going to focus in on some of those meetings throughout this evening. But at its basic level, what this week's portion is dealing with is how Moses, following God's command, appointed people to be in the position of treasurers to collect and organize the raw materials that the people donated for the tabernacle's construction, for artisans to fashion the building and its furnishings, and for the Levites to dismantle, transport, erect, and safeguard the tabernacle. So God tells Moses to appoint people, to reckon people, to take an account of things, that all this stuff that was donated to build the tabernacle, and kind of make sense of it, kind of sort it out. Then the Torah goes on to list some of the tallies of the raw materials, and then it describes how the artisans made the high priest's special garments, like the ephod, the breastplate, the robe, the forehead plate that we'll talk about a little bit later, together with the other priest's garments, like the tunics, the headgear, the sashes, the pants. In previous Torah Tuesdays, that's always a good idea to listen to previous archives of the same week's portion. We've talked about those items of clothing and what their symbolic value was, including as it related to our Messiah, Yeshua. The Torah then describes how people presented to Moses all the components of the tabernacle itself, and the making of which was described in last week's portion, Vayechel. Now, from a calendar perspective, everything was completed and ready by the 25th of the month of Kislev. You Hebrew calendar scholars, 25th of Kislev sound familiar? Yeah, that's during the time of Hanukkah, all right? A mere 2.5 months after Moses had descended Mount Sinai for the very last time, which was on Yom Kippur, was the 25th of Kislev, and they had everything ready. So it took 2.5 months to get all this stuff together. But God instructed Moses to wait until the first day of the month of Nisan, because he had designated that to be the first month of the Hebrew calendar. So they were to wait until Nisan to erect the tabernacle. This official dedication was to be preceded by a week-long kind of warm-up that would begin on the 23rd day of the month of Adar. That's when the tabernacle, during this week-long warm-up, was set up and dismantled every day for a week leading up to that. Now, you may want to listen to previous classes, because we talked about what the significance of having a week-long warm-up was for, because it was Moses doing it instead of Aaron, and kind of what that was all about. But after recounting God's instruction concerning how the tabernacle should be erected, the Torah then tells how, indeed, on the first of Nisan of the next year, Moses erected the tabernacle, and that God's presence manifested itself within it. The dramatic event closes not only the portion, but the book of Exodus itself. Now, Pekudei completes the account that it was actually begun last week in Vayechel, of how Moses and the people fashioned the physical tabernacle, its furnishings, and the priest's garment. But whereas the name Vayechel, meaning he assembled, meaning Moses assembled the people, if you remember from last week, Vayechel emphasized how the parts formed a unified whole. Unity was the major theme of Vayechel. Pekudei emphasizes the importance of each individual part. All right? So Vayechel emphasizes the unity as a whole. Pekudei emphasizes the importance of the actual individual parts. And so these two portions teach us about unity from opposite perspectives. Namely, that each of us is part of the whole of God's people. That's Vayechel, that's last week. And that each of us has intrinsic value as an individual person. That's Pekudei, this week's portion. As the conclusion of the book of Exodus, Exodus, of course, being the chronicle and the pattern of redemption, it's what set the prototype of what redemption is, what redemption looks like, how redemption operates. It's the blueprint for it. These two portions teach us that the fusion of our individual and communal identities as people of God is an essential facet of redemption itself, both personal redemption and collective universal redemption. Both in order to actualize our potential to the fullest and to experience the full redemption from the bondage of physical and spiritual exile. It is essential for us to realize that our worth as individuals on the one hand, and to realize that we can actualize our potential to the fullest only when we work within the context of the greater whole, to make the world into God's true home, where God and humanity truly dwell together. So when you take these two portions together, because they usually are read together, it stresses the importance of the individual, but then lets you know that you can only be a true individual if you're actually part of an authentic community and part of something bigger than yourself. That they go hand in hand. If you aren't connected to a community that's bigger than you are, then you aren't actually being an individual the way God created you to be. You are unique, you are an individual, God made you the way you are, with gifts and talents and all of that, but you are not made to exercise that without being in the context of the community and as being unified as a whole. Only when all individuals come together to make a whole are you actually then an individual. And that's the paradox of it. That's the paradox of last week's portion, this week's portion, when you read them together. That's why these last two portions of Exodus really speak very much to contemporary society. Because contemporary society, we live in a culture that greatly emphasizes the individual. The individual's right to choose, the individual's right to everything, happiness and all that. It's about me, 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 the individual. But at the same time, and there's all kinds of gadgets that are designed to tickle the individual, but at the same time, everybody's lonely. And everybody's empty and hollow because they're not part of something bigger than themselves. But they don't know how to be part of something bigger than themselves. And they will never be fully an individual, never be fully content with just who they are as one created in God's image until they are put into the puzzle that they are a piece of. And then once they're snapped into place, then they realize who they are as an individual, but then they also have their identity in community. So this idea of longing to belong, as much as we praise the individual, we also crave to belong, crave to be loved, crave to be accepted. Those two tensions of being your own person, but also being loved and accepted and having lots of friends and family. Those two dichotomies are how does that look? How does that work itself out? That's actually addressed in these last two portions. What does this really look like? Okay. So that's a snapshot of this week's portion, but as it also ties in with last week's portion, because again, when it's not a leap year in the Hebrew calendar, these two are together. And that's why they are together, because they talk about what unity and individuality is, but from opposite perspectives, and show this how this thesis and antithesis become a synthesis. Okay. So that's kind of the introduction to this week's reading, what goes on in the reading, kind of a core of its theme. So now let's look at it a little bit in depth. The inner mikdash, the tabernacle. So the purpose of the Mishkan, as it's also called, the tabernacle, is stated in a verse that we've quoted many times because it's very, very important, and therefore we say it a lot because we need to hear it a lot and because we need to learn it a lot, okay? Exodus 25, verse 8, "They shall make for me a mikdash, a holy place, and I shall dwell in with and among them." Rather than saying that God will dwell within it, which in Hebrew would have been besoko, the text says that God wishes to dwell within them, besokam, meaning to dwell within the heart of each and every individual. The physical construction of the tabernacle was only a vehicle for God's true design to find a dwelling place within the hearts and minds of his beloved children. So the tabernacle in its structure is really just the vehicle, the map, for not God dwelling in it, but for God dwelling in us. And this again is why Shaul can talk about us being temples of the Holy Spirit and so forth, because a mikdash is really wherever God causes his presence to dwell. And his desire isn't to dwell in a mobile worship center any more than his desire is to dwell in a building on 15th and Main. His desire is to dwell in your heart, in your mind, in your thought process, govern your worldview, govern your decision-making process, govern how you view other people, see the world around you. That's where he really wants to dwell. And the tabernacle system is the vehicle for achieving that, but it's also describing how it's done within us as well. And so the Shlah could write this: "One must always preserve the sanctity of the heart, so that it might be truly a Kodesh HaKodeshim, a Holy of Holies, so that the Shekinah, that God's presence, can dwell. And so regarding this, David HaMelech," King David prayed, "a pure heart create for me, O God." Psalm 51:12. "If a person sullies his heart with thoughts of sin, he is therefore guilty of bringing into the Holy of Holies an idol." And the Chasim Sofer notes how the Torah informs us that the construction of the tabernacle, it was interrupted, if you remember from the Torah reading, to rest on the Sabbath, right? So they worked hard 6 days a week, but they were clearly instructed to rest on the Sabbath. While the laws of the Sabbath are suspended, if it's necessary to preserve a person's life, all right? So as holy as the Sabbath is, the Sabbath ranks above the tabernacle and eventually the temple. The Sabbath is holier. But human life ranks above the Sabbath because you can interrupt your observance of the Sabbath in order to save a person's life. You can listen to Chronicles of Messiah classes about Yeshua's teaching on all of this. And so if the Sabbath is more important than the tabernacle, and human life is more important than the Sabbath, we must conclude that life is holier and more precious to God than the tabernacle or the temple. And this is the exact same logic that Yeshua uses, right? When he says, God doesn't desire sacrifices. What he desires is mercy and justice and chesed and, you know, compassion and so forth. He's actually pulling from Hosea, where Hosea, the prophet, makes this same kind of argumentation, right? The Sabbath superseded tabernacle / temple, and life supersedes the Sabbath. So life, therefore, a person's life to God is more important than the temple itself, the tabernacle, the sacrificial system, all these rites and rituals, humanity, human life trumps all of those. Okay? We can well understand the reason for this, since the primary location of the divine presence in this world is not in the structure of the tabernacle or the temple, but in the heart of the believer. In this regard, the Midrash refers to the Zadokim, the righteous ones, as a merchava leshachinah, a chariot of the divine presence. Since God's interaction with his world is felt through their actions far more than through any inanimate structure. Right? In other words, God is the reason human life is valued more than the tabernacle and the temple is because that's really where God has chosen to dwell. And that's where God has chosen to reveal himself. And it comes through each generation's righteous teachers, prophets, and so forth. David, King David, you may remember, planned to build the temple, right? And, see, you're about to learn, well, that's true, but here's another side to that, right? What do you know is the reason why David doesn't get to build the temple? He has blood on his hands. Is that true? Yes, that's true, right? I know the scriptures say that. But I'm about to tell you another reason, and a higher level reason, why King David wasn't to build the temple, right? And it fits more if you've ever had that quandary of, it says David is a man after God's own heart, right? And yet you want to think about he couldn't build the temple. This is going to help you reconcile it. Because where does God really want to dwell according to the book of Exodus? It's not in the tabernacle / temple. It's in the heart, right? And especially in the heart of the righteous ones, and the righteous one, which King David, of course, is the great foreshadow, fractal of Messiah himself. So, looking at 1 Kings 8, verse 18, you now, with Hebraic ears and eyes, can hear a different, deeper reason why David wasn't to build the temple. There, God says to David, the thoughts of your heart are tov. They're good. They're pure. And so you will not build my house. In other words, I'm already dwelling in your temple. Because your heart is after my heart. Your heart is good. I'm already dwelling in the temple you are to build. That is the temple of your heart. Right? It's right there in 1 Kings if you know to read it that way. The Tiferet Shlomo explains that the thoughts of David's heart were far more favorable to God than any physical structure of a temple that he could build. And that's actually the ultimate reason that disqualified him. Because of the condition of his heart. It was already right with God. The high priest's crown. Two types of listening. related to kind of two types of wisdom that we discussed last week with the abstract and the practical, and where we often think the abstract's the awesome and the end-all be-all, but in reality it's the practical that is the deeper wisdom, because it's one thing to know all kinds of awesome things, and it's another thing to actually know what to do with knowing all kinds of awesome things, right? So, similarly related, but also its own unique flavor here. One of the more striking special garments that was worn by the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, was what is known as the tzitz. Right? This was a gold plate tied around the forehead that had these words engraved on it. Kadosh LeHashem, holy to the Lord. What was the significance of this priestly crown? Well, Rav Cook of Blessed Memory explained that the tzitz was fashioned out of pure gold, which reflected the loftiest spiritual riches. You may remember before when we talked about what were the three materials, main materials used. You had gold, silver, and copper, right? And the levels that they represented. So gold reflecting the loftiest spiritual riches. The crown's placement on the forehead, all right? The forehead representing the location of our inner drive. In Hebrew, what's known as the ratzon, our will. For good and holiness. This symbolized the priest's aspiration for the highest good contained within his soul. The Talmud teaches that the tzitz encircled the Kohen's, the priest's forehead, from one ear to the other. Now, that's just a circle, really, right? I mean, you know, it could have just said it circled his head, but you're good Hebraic thinkers, so the fact that it describes it from starting at one ear and going around and ending at the other ear, why is it choosing to use ears as the description? All right? So it's interesting that the ears are mentioned. Well, the ear is an organ, of course, which we use to hear and listen. One aspect of listening, which is represented by one ear, is the listening we have that's directed above. It's the ear that we have that is, or potentially is not, receptive to elevated thought, that is geared towards spiritual things, to gear toward hearing the things of God, the words of God, the will of God, the ways of God, and is hearing elevated thought. The tzitz extends from this ear to the forehead, indicating that its function was to conduct the lofty thoughts to the priest's inner will, that he was to hear, connect, have elevated thoughts, holy thoughts, godly thoughts, and it was then to connect to his will, who he was, what he desired, how he saw reality. In short, it symbolized the priest's aspiration to actualize his loftiest goals, implement them in his life, his character traits, and his deeds. It's taking what was his potential energy as being one created in the image of God and also anointed to be a high priest or to be a priest, to take that potential and to put it into actuality, to actualize the potential. A major theme we've hit in Torah class, right? The potential we all have, right? And the Torah is the blueprint to take the essentially infinite potential energy we have and actualize it. Much like we're now learning to do, even like with the sun. Like the sun, yes, we know, keeps us in a rotational pattern and it keeps us warm and gives us light and this and that. But we're now also learning to harness even more of its power, right? We can power houses and cities, and we're learning more and more about solar energy. Like the potential of what the sun can do is really infinite if we can just learn how to grab the energy, properly channel it and properly get it through the conduits, it could power power a whole planet. You know, it's there. That's what's in all of us. We have this immense potential energy as being created in the image of God, belonging to God, being part of the essence of who God is, but it's buried under so much gunk and clutter and shell that the Torah is the way that we chip through that so that it becomes reality. So this is the one ear moving around to the priest's forehead. The second aspect of listening is our ability to be aware of the physical world around us. It's not as that we learned when before when the children of Israel had to take over and take the land, right? They went from a purely spiritual existence to this blended existence, right? It's not enough that we just be purely spiritual beings, right? We're not created for that. We're not wired that way. And so the other year is that we are also attuned to this world. And that's represented by the second ear. This connection allows the physical world to acquire new inner content while providing practical knowledge which could not be attained just in the spiritual realm. Here, the spiritual is enriched through insight into the material world, its actions and its emotions. The zits encompass both types of listening, receptiveness to lofty spiritual ideas from above, and practical understanding from the physical world below. The zits provided a channel connecting these two realms, uniting the world with all of its disparate parts. In this way, the high priest could become a whole person. He could become integrated, aware of how the physical can extend and enrich the spiritual realm, and vice versa. He could serve as a unifying force for the people. He could share the yearning for complete unity. This ability to bridge the physical and the spiritual worlds, which is, that's what that piece represents. It's bridging the physical and the spiritual world, corresponds to the essence of the mission of the high priest. The priest, especially the high priest, was essentially a conduit, right? And so, again, we're getting this idea of spiritual technology. So I want you to think about opening up your computer, cracking open your notebook, or taking the back of your phone off, or looking inside your desktop, and you see all of those circuits and wires and conduits and all of those connections, portals and plugs, right? This is what the tabernacle was. This is spiritual technology, right? Of bringing heaven down to earth and bringing earth up to heaven, right? And so the priest, Zitz, was a critical part of this spiritual technology. It's what made the priest a conduit. It's what enabled the priest to connect God to the people and the people to God. The Talmud describes the priest as Sheluchei Didan, our representatives, because they bring our offerings to God. But they also describe him as Sheluchei Derachamana, that is, God's emissaries that bring God's grace and blessings to us. The placement of the zits encompass both ears, indicating the high priest should not suffer from a disconnect between his spiritual and his physical side. Dare we say a disconnect between his two natures. As a conduit between humanity and God, he needed to be attuned to the spiritual while still in touch with the material world. Now, if I've discussed all of that, go back and listen to it again, and hopefully you will hear messianic overtones of why Yeshua is our high priest, right? Because that's exactly what he is. He is spiritual technology. He is the conduit between heaven and earth. That is the mission of the high priest. Right? And his garments were an important part of that. Just like if you take off the back of your phone and you see a blue wire going from here to there and you're like, I'll just unplug that blue wire. Will your phone work the same? No. Parts of it still may work, but parts of it may act really crazy, right? Or may just kind of short out the whole thing, right? So the high priest had this very specific function of being able to be the conduit, the interface between God and the people and the people in God, bringing the blessings from God down to the people, bringing the offerings of the people up to God. Right? And his clothing and all of that all kind of speak to this kind of technology. Okay. The power of one. All right. This is kind of the big one for the evening. Really sets and establishes what Pekudei is about. It's a really short reading, especially on its own when it's not combined with Vayechel. This is really what Pekudei is, what I'm about to talk about. Contrast and concord. So what is the true importance of just an individual, right? We hear things, we're now in election season, we're about in our fourth year of election season. right? And we often can hear things around that this time of like, does one vote matter? What does one vote matter? Can one person really change the election, right? And things like that. What is the true importance of a single individual? On one hand, as we talked about earlier, our society, often exaggerates the importance of the individual, of personal gratification, of individual satisfaction. It just hammers home individuality. But on the other hand, in actual life, as we personally experience it, many people feel dwarfed by their surroundings, insignificant before the raging sea of experience to which contemporary life exposes us. We feel hollow, we feel incomplete, we feel as if something just isn't right, even though we may be the most touting of individuality that the world could ever know, there's still something we know is missing. In other words, our society emphasizes the individual, yet at the same time, so many individuals feel just unimportant, disconnected, and just flat out alienated. These concepts receive focus in this week's portion of Pekudei. The word Pekudei, as I talked about at the beginning, one of its meanings means reckoning, a reckoning. This refers on a peshat level to the tallying of the gold and the silver and the copper and all of that that were donated for the tabernacle, for the building of the sanctuary, and the inventory of all its utensils and services. Now, any reckoning involves an interplay of antithetical concepts. So here's your methodology lesson. The Torah and the Torah worldview and the Hebrew mind is antithetical, right? It's dialectic. Thesis, antithesis, synthesis, synthesis, thesis, antithesis, synthesis. It's constantly going back and forth to reach a census, right? It's never either or. It's always both and, but the idea with both and is it isn't just both and, it's how it's both and, which it becomes in and of itself its own entity, and where it's greater than the sum of its individual parts, right? So that's fundamental if you're going to understand the Torah correctly, right? It's antithetical. The fact that a reckoning is required presumes the existence of a multitude of elements. Otherwise, you don't need to account for them. You don't need to reckon them. You don't need to count them. The focus of a reckoning, however, is not the multitude, but rather the individual entities which comprise it. And yet the ultimate importance of each individual element actually stems from the fact that it exists as part of a whole. Right? So do you hear the thesis, antithesis there, right? You have the individual being important, but you realize that its importance only stems from the fact that it's part of a whole. So on one hand, the tabernacle is dependent on its individual elements. If one of those elements, no matter how tiny, is lacking, the tabernacle as a whole is incomplete. Again, it's like opening up your desktop computer and saying, well, there's at least 25 wires. Is it really that big a deal if I unplug one? Yes, it is, right? No matter how small or how insignificant, and no matter if it takes your computer running 6 months before you find out how that glitches it, right? No matter how small or insignificant, it matters. If one of those is missing, the tabernacle is incomplete, and its spiritual technology will not function. It will be unfit to serve as God's resting place. Simultaneously, the whole, which is formed by the combination of these elements, is far more than just the sum of its parts. Here, 1 + 1 does not equal 2. It actually equals 3 or more. When brought together, the different elements of the tabernacle are granted a measure of importance that surpasses their individual value. By being part of the sanctuary, the tabernacle, each element fosters the revelation of God's presence. God is revealed uniquely through their function as the individual. But only by being part of the whole does the individual actually experience that, and therefore actually experience their individuality. So if you really want to be an individual, you need to be part of something, you need to be part of a spiritual technology machine where you realize your importance. Without you, this thing does not function. Without you, this is completely incomplete. And as the portion ends, how does Book of Exodus end? It ends when everything's erected and what? The cloud just swoops in and like they plugged it into the wall and the thing booted up. Right? That's what's really being described. That's the metaphor. If it were written now, that would be the metaphor. Because clouds flying down don't mean anything to us, but we clearly get booting up. Right? They built all of these pieces, very precise, put them in the exact locations, got everything ready, and man, when they plugged it up, it booted up and it worked. Right? You as an individual are needed for that. So you're important, right? And individuality is therefore stressed. But it's also useless unless you're functioning with other individuals where you become something that's bigger than who you are, bigger than yourself, right? True accomplishment. Every person's heart is described as a tabernacle and microcosm, or fractal of the tabernacle. And every act of worship in the tabernacle is also reflected in our divine service today. Similarly, with regard to the concepts that we've been discussing, every individual must appreciate that he or she is far greater than his or her individual self. That's the part of individuality that's not being stressed now. All right? You are far greater than just your individual self. You contain the potential to serve as part of what would be known as Klal Yisrael, the people of God as a whole, that you become part of the medium for the revelation of God's presence in our world. But how is this potential realized? Well, one, when a person develops his or her own abilities to the utmost, shouldering all the responsibility that's been given to them, and when he or she joins together with others engaged in the same task. Thus, they become part of a greater whole. This is why, like, liturgical worship is important. And that's why many people, if once they become spiritually mature, if they've never experienced liturgical worship, when they actually do experience it, they can't explain why it seems holier or why it seems deeper and all that. It's what the reason why that is because you realize, your soul realizes, I'm connecting to something bigger than myself. I'm not just showing up to worship for me. It's not just about me, and if I hear a good sermon, and if I come away edified, and if I come away praising, and I come away entertained, and I come away happy, all of that is important. But it's not just about that. It's also about the fact that I'm saying words that followers of Yeshua died to say 1700 years ago, and that have been murdered for 2000 years for saying, I'm part of something bigger than just me. So I'm here as an individual. I'm individually feeding my own soul by exposing myself to these truths and all that. But you also, your soul is finally going, finally, you are plugging me in. You're finally taking my six prongs that are poking out and putting me into six holes and pushing me in so that I can click. Instead, I've been just these six prongs running around going, me, 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 me. But when you hit something that's bigger than you are, when you actually are part of a liturgical service where the words you say are the words Yeshua said when he was in the synagogue, then your soul's like, click. Now it makes sense. And so, as an individual, you must remember you're bigger than just your individuality. And if you want to fully experience who you are as a person, you have to plug into something bigger than yourself. The importance of this step was highlighted in last week's portion, Vayakhel. Thus, it is more than coincidence, again, that these two portions are often read together. On the one hand, Vayakhel, last week's portion, and this week's portion may appear contradictory. But you remember, Hebraic mind thinks not contradictions. There are no such things as contradiction. That's Western logic. And please realize that the logic you're taught in school is consistent within itself. And so there do exist contradictions in a Western Hellenistic logical system. Here may be the great discovery for you. That's not the only system. That's not the only way of viewing reality. Right? The one you were raised with is not the only one that existed. Yeshua did not know Western logic. And the Hebraic mind, the Eastern mind at large. Remember, Yeshua is not just Jewish. Yeshua is Asian. Yeshua is Asian. So he's Eastern. Eastern thought knows no contradiction. It knows dialectic thinking. It knows antithetical thinking. It knows thesis, antithesis. How are these two, when combined, greater than each one of them individually? Right? So last week's portion, this week's portion may at first seem contradictory, but in fact, where Vayakhel emphasizes the fusion of the individuals into a spiritual collective, where Pekudei underscores the personal contribution of every person. But a collective will be incomplete unless it includes every individual, and unless it allows each of those individuals to be fully developed for who they truly are. Simultaneously, each individual must realize that he or she will not reach their full potential until they actually join with others in the system, until they plug into the spiritual technology. What lies at the core? The possibility exists of forging a unified whole from divergent parts only because each of these components already share a fundamental connection. Every person's soul is created in the image of God, and therefore every person's soul contains some actual part of God, but different parts of God. It's again like a puzzle. Therefore, despite the differences between individuals, individuals are actually bound together by a basic commonality. We're all created in the image of God. That's why no matter how much you want to emphasize individuality, you're never going to get away from wanting to belong to something bigger than yourself in a community, because your technology has wired you. You're part of a puzzle. And until you're put in the puzzle, you feel like the missing piece that no one's found yet that's underneath the table. And you're like, please, please find me and put me in the puzzle, right? Now, you're important as that individual piece, especially if you're the last piece. Wow, how treasured you are. How special an individual piece you really are. But at the same time, you're really not special until we actually put you into the puzzle. All right? That's the balance of individuality, community. Right? That's how it has to be. Each individual must realize this aspect of them. So the world at large, every particle of existence is maintained by God's creative energy, and this common ground generates the potential we all have for unity. Because we all are created in the image of God, we all share the very thing that that will and can unite us. Keeping one's balance sheet. As mentioned, the reckoning in Pekudei includes the account of the sums of gold and silver and all those things that were donated for the tabernacle, and the account of its utensils and its services. Now, pay attention to the order. First, an inventory was taken of the resources that were available, and then a reckoning was made of how those resources were used. That's the order. First, it was how much gold, silver, copper, and stuff do we have? And then how many utensils do we have for service? So first, what were the resources available? Then, how were these resources used? These concepts are relevant to our divine service today. First, a person must take inventory. He or she must know who or she is and what they can do. Like, who are they? What are they? A corner piece? Are they an end piece? Are they a middle piece? Are they a big piece? Oh, what can they do? What do they offer? They have to know. You have to know yourself. Afterwards, from time to time, one must determine how well these abilities are actually being used and what one has accomplished with them. The sequence is significant. Awareness of the existence of one potential serves as the prod to spur you to its realization. So first, how much gold, silver, and brass, and copper, and tekelet, and wool do you have? And then, how many utensils you make out of that? What kind of utensils you got with that? What's being made with that? What's being done with that? The catalyst for personal development. The Torah reading begins, this is the reckoning, Pekudei, of the tabernacle, the sanctuary, which was calculated by Moses. The reckoning of the different elements of the tabernacle, and correspondingly the reckoning of the abilities of every individual, is dependent on the input of Moses. It was Moses who arouses their potential, and after all the elements of the sanctuary were completed, it was Moses who erected it and inaugurated it for its service. He's the one that put the cord in and hit the power button. It was Moses' leadership which stimulated the expression of each individual's inner potential to encourage its interaction with that of others. And again, here Moses is serving as a foreshadow, a fractal, a type of Messiah and his role in our life. No end to growth. Pekodei does not conclude with the construction of the sanctuary, but it mentions two further points: that the cloud rested upon it and the glory of God filled it, and that indeed the sanctuary had become a resting place for the presence of God. And when the cloud arose, the children of Israel set forth on their journey, which teaches that divine service requires constant progress. These two points are fundamental to the reckoning of every person that must take in their own lives. Each must know that the ultimate goal is the revelation of God's presence, God's reality in your life. And each must realize that it's impossible to rest on one's laurels. The ongoing revelation of God's presence involves continual advancement. You're to be a tabernacle. What's unique about the tabernacle? How is the tabernacle different than the temple? Tabernacle moved, right? It moved from place to place. It hit 42 stops, right? Remember those 42 stops, right? The 42 stops you take in your life? We have control only over our actions, not the outcome. This is a pretty important musar from this week's reading here. Exodus 39, verse 32. Now, I'm going to read it kind of literally from the Hebrew, so it may sound a little choppy, but I'm reading it the way it's supposed to be read, right? And then I'll unpack it. Exodus 39, 32. All the work of the tabernacle, the tent of meeting, was completed. And the children of Israel had done everything that God commanded Moses. So did they do. Right? Anyone's translation sound like that, or did it smooth it out for you? Probably smooth it out for you, which is a no-no. Right? It's got some redundancy in there for a reason. It's also got it in what may appear to be a backwards order. Alright? All the work of the tabernacle, the tent of meeting was completed, the children of Israel had done everything God commanded Moses. So did they do. It would seem that logically the order of this verse should be reversed. That the children of Israel did everything God commanded, so they did, and then all the work of the tabernacle and the tent of meeting was completed. In other words, that they did what they were told, and it was completed. But instead it begins with, it was completed. Why does the Torah tell us that the tabernacle was completed before it tells us that the Israelites did as they were commanded? The answer is that if the order were reversed, it would indicate that it was because of the Israelites who did the work as the reason why the tabernacle was completed. The fact is that the tabernacle was actually completed by God and by God alone, after the Israelites did all they were commanded. The completion of the tabernacle was indeed the result of their effort, but their effort alone could not have done it. It was because they tried their utmost that they merited that God would complete it. Right? So this is, again, the age-old adage of we need to be Messiah-like, we need to be like our Messiah. I'm not perfect, I'm not the Son of God, I can't be like Yeshua, so why try? If you don't try, it's correct. But here's the beauty of this passage. When you do, God actually does it for you. But if you don't do, nothing gets done. Right? Same with Abraham. Go, get up and go, and I'll show you the land. Well, Abraham could have just said, look, God, I'm going to mess up. I'm human. I know I'm going to disobey. You're going to end up giving me the land anyways. Can't you just do it? And I don't need to leave. Right? Abraham actually had to go, and he had to go through all of that. But ultimately, did Abraham come to the land himself? Did he find the land himself? No! But if Abraham would have sat in his driveway, he'd have sat in his driveway. Alright? That's the importance of this order. Right? So, there's no excuses for us. Right? Wait. God does the work. God is the one. God's sovereignty is never questioned. The impeccable nature of grace, all of it. But at the same time, if we don't do, it doesn't activate it. But when it's activated, it is in us. It's God. Right? That's the bizarre wording of that text. That's why it's specifically phrased that way. This is a lesson that we should apply in every walk of life. In virtually everything we do, there are many factors beyond our control that can affect the outcome. We just know that. We are responsible only for what we do and not for what ultimately emerges. This does not hold true, however, in commerce or in a society that values capitalism above all else. A person may begin a business with a total disregard for every principle of economy, and if he makes a windfall profit, it's considered as if he were an excellent businessman, even though he's a complete goofball, right? And there are a couple of billionaires that are like that. People think they're geniuses. They aren't geniuses. Are they billionaires? Yes. They are not geniuses. And they are not people, if you modeled their style, you would be bankrupt in a second, right? But our society is so bent on, you got rich, you're a genius. Where on the other hand, if someone prepares carefully for a business venture, attends to every detail properly, and the business ultimately fails, he will be thought of as a poor businessman and a failure whose methods should not be considered. People will invest their money with the one who has the best outcome, not with the one who has the best method. But see, we are so involved in materialism, in economics, in capitalism, that we unfortunately apply these principles to our spiritual lives and our ethical issues as well. Parents who try to raise their children in the best possible way, but in the end have a child with errant behavior, they tend to feel guilty that they were not good enough parents, that they failed. I've seen, and you probably have too, seen where parents who were self-indulgent, ego-driven, just not good parents at all, neglecting their children, had a child that turned out to be a very fine person, a credit to society and a complete success. The parents who cared and tried, they are good parents. Even if the child turned out to be a disappointment, at least up to that point. And the parents who were negligent, they were bad parents. Even if their child grew up to be a great person and a credit to society, they were still bad parents. Of Abraham, God said this in Genesis 18, verse 19. For I have loved him because he commands his children and his household after him that they keep the way of God, that they do charity and they do justice. God said that's why he loved Abraham, because he commanded his children and his household to keep the way of God, to do charity and to do justice. God loved Abraham for doing what was best for his children, to teach them in God's ways. But Abraham's son Ishmael didn't follow his father's teachings. And similarly, Isaac had a son Esau, who was also a bit of a scoundrel. But that does not detract from Isaac's great spirituality either. Neither Abraham or Isaac are held responsible in any way, shape, or form at all in the scriptures for the unfavorable outcome of their children. The phraseology describing the construction of the tabernacle makes this point. We must do what we can. We must do all that we can. But we must realize the final product is really out of our hands. And this is emunah. That the final outcome is ultimately in God's hands, for God's purposes, which were always good, no matter what it may seem to us. It may not be a great thing that that guy's a billionaire. And it might have been the best thing that ever happened to that guy that his business failed. That's emunah. That the final result, the outcome, is always God. And it's always good. We are not responsible for the outcome. We are only responsible for doing the will of God. And then God does it. God does the outcome, whatever it is. All right. We will close there for this evening. It's a rather short portion, but loaded with stuff. Again, listen to it again. I know it was a dense teaching. The short portions tend to be very dense that way. This aspect of the individuality and being part of something bigger than yourself before you actually are an individual, just keep listening to that until you really grasp the depth of what the Torah is teaching there. Because it really does give a lot of answers to the predicament our culture has found itself in. It desperately wants to belong to something bigger than itself, and it desperately wants to be individualistic. It's only a Torah worldview that seemingly can reconcile those apparent contradictions of individuality within community. And that you aren't an individual without a community, and you aren't a community unless you're full of individuals. Right? So the Pekudei really works at reckoning how this works out. All right. Well, let's close with the blessing. Baruch atah Adonai, noten haTorah. Blessed are you, Lord, the giver of the Torah. Amen.